My name is James Angus and I'm the Dean of the Faculty of Medicine, Dentistry and Health Sciences. I begin by acknowledging the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations, the traditional owners of the land on which the University of Melbourne stands. I am delighted to welcome Professor Blackburn back to the University of Melbourne, and on behalf of the University, to congratulate her not only on being awarded the world's top scientific prize, the Nobel Prize in Medicine or Physiology, but also on her distinguished career and for her contributions as an international advisor in bioethics. This lecture is presented in partnership between the University of Melbourne, the Australasian Associations of Clinical Biochemists, the Human Genetics Society of Australasia, and the Royal College of Pathologists of Australia. And it is now my great pleasure to hand over to Professor Leslie Burnett, President of the Australasian Association of Clinical Biochemists. Leslie.
Thank you, Professor Angus. Chancellor, Professor Blackburn, Professor Siddharth, ladies and gentlemen. It is a rare individual who is able to cross the orders of magnitude between the molecular, the cellular, population genetics, and finally the ethics and the politics of science and research itself. But such is Professor Blackburn. Professor Blackburn is a leader and was the discoverer of the aglet of nature, the telomere at the end of the chromosome, and from that discovered telomerase and the ribonuclear protein enzyme. Her discoveries have had a profound effect and have opened up entire areas of medical and scientific research. She has a distinguished career and has received many honours in the course and recognition in the course of that career, of which a short summary is. So she's an elected fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences from 1991, the Royal Society of London, 1992, the American Academy of Microbiology, 1993. She was elected president of the American Society for Cell Biology in 1998 and the American Association for Advancement of Science, 2000. She was elected Foreign Associate of the National Academy of Science in 1993, a member of the Institute of Medicine in 2000, and was awarded the Albert Lasker Medical Research Award in Basic Medical Research 2006. But with apologies to Peter Allen, the songwriter, she still calls Australia home. Born in Tasmania, she studied here at the University of Melbourne, went on to MRC Cambridge and Yale before moving to California, which being with UC Berkeley and UC San Francisco. She retained her Australian citizenship and in the New Year's Honours List was conferred the Commander of the Order of Australia. And today she returns to her alma mater, University of Melbourne University, to deliver a public lecture, Telomeres and Telomerase in Human Health and Disease. Chancellor, ladies and gentlemen, I take great pleasure in inviting to the dais Professor Elizabeth Blackburn, recipient of the 2009 Nobel Prize in Medicine or Physiology.
Thank you very much, and thank you so much for the opportunity to be able to speak with you this evening at my old alma mater, as you said. It's lovely to be back, and you know, you forget how beautiful the trees are in the summer around the University of Melbourne campus. It's good to be back. So, without further ado, I'd like to begin and tell you about telomeres, which are the ends of chromosomes, and they cap off the ends of chromosomes. So this would be a chromosome here depicted as the blue, and this is a pair of chromosomes that are recently duplicated, so each blue looks double. And DNA has a problem replicating out at the very ends, and so special structures at the ends have to exist. And so we can think of them in some ways, in this rather fanciful depiction, as being a sort of capping off of the ends of the DNA, although please don't take this picture too literally. But again, a metaphor is sometimes helpful. And a rather useful one is to think of a shoelace, and think of the shoelace as one of your chromosomes, which carries, of course, all your precious genetic information. And at the ends of the chromosome, there's a little metal or plastic tip. And this tip, if it's sufficiently well built, will prevent the ends of the chromosome, or in this case, the shoelace, from fraying away. So if the shoelace tip gets too short, as it does in the case of telomeres in the course of natural wear and tear, then it'll eventually disappear and the fraying can begin. And so really, perhaps this tip is perhaps not so much like the rigid little metal or a plastic tip that a shoelace would have, but think of it more as perhaps being a little bit more like wax and sort of melting down over time. And so this analogy is, I think, a reasonably apt analogy. Now, of course, we know much, much more at a molecular level, and I've just hinted at some of the properties in terms of the molecular idea of what goes on at chromosome ends over on this side of the slide, talking about the fact that telomeric DNA has binding sites for protective proteins. These make higher order complexes whose architecture is still being worked out, and basically stop the ends from fraying away. Now, I want to tell you a little bit about some of the beginnings of how I got involved in understanding some of the molecular features of telomeres, in part because I want to then relate some of these findings to what we're doing and what many others are doing more currently. And the story began with a ciliated protozoan shown in the scanning electron microscope here, a single-celled organism that lives harmlessly in ponds. You can sort of think of it as a pond scum organism. It's not green, though. It's called Tetrahymena thermophila. And the relevant point here was that it wasn't a medically important organism or anything. It was a biologically, experimentally amenable system for looking at the ends of DNAs because it had abundant, very short, linear chromosomes, for interesting reasons that are not relevant, especially here. Now, what I found when I joined Joe Gall's lab at Yale University in the 1970s was that the very end of the chromosome had simple repeated sequences. They had the sequence TTGGGG over and over and over at the ends of all these little short chromosomes. And so one of the questions was, how did they get there? A lot of clues started pointing to the idea that maybe they got built onto the ends by an enzyme which didn't yet exist, but the telomeres were behaving in ways that were not conforming to the textbooks. And so I was joined by Carol Grider in my lab, shown here with her California uniform on at the time. Those are Mickey Mouse ears, for those of you in the back. She'd just come back from a trip. And so a very talented student, and she joined my lab, and we'd started to hunt for telomerase, as we started to call this enzyme much later, but this activity, and Carol joined the hunt and succeeded. And so simply, the idea was that if you made a short piece of DNA in the test tube, and I've just depicted it as blocks here, but these are the building blocks of the DNA, and if you simply incubated it with an extract we found of Tetrahymena cells, broke open the cells, gave it the right goodies and building blocks, that piece of synthetic telomere could grow and could add, in fact, in the test tube, you know, remarkably large numbers of repeated sequences. And so that was the very beginning of our being sure that there was something here going on worth pursuing, and in the end we were able to get an idea of what it was. And so it can be depicted somewhat like this. So now envisage a chromosome. This is this blue thing up here, and if we looked at the very, very tip, we would now see the DNA in double-stranded form here, and these are the building blocks shown on both strands here. And then one of the DNA strands protrudes, and then it can be elongated by copying along this short RNA sequence that's a part of the enzyme telomerase, which is made of both RNA and protein. And so what we did was we deduced that this elongation was taking place, copying the template as we thought it was sequence. So then we had to test that this was actually true. So I was joined by some other graduate students, notably Guo Liang Yu, and some other students in my lab, and we said, let's make changes in this putative template sequence and then put such an RNA into the cells, substituting for the normal telomerase RNA. Now, if this is true, now that G, by the rules of DNA getting copied, should be copied into a C. And then that would be that repeat that was added. And then the previous round, there would have been a C added. When that last repeat was added, and the previous round previous to that, a C would have been added here. And then Guo Liang took out the DNA from the cells, and he sequenced it, and lo and behold, there were these nucleotides in there. So it said, aha, this is actually true. This sequence is being copied into DNA. We were quite excited because this was actually the first time a cellular enzyme, as opposed to a viral enzyme, like a retroviral enzyme, now we think of things like HIV as typical retroviruses or retroelements, such an enzyme that copies RNA into DNA hadn't been seen for a normal cellular enzyme. The copying of RNA into DNA was sort of thought to be, you know, the province of, you know, renegades like viruses and retroviruses. So this was in itself a very interesting kind of thing, that RNA was being copied into DNA by apparently a cellular enzyme. So now the question was, this elongation of the DNA was something that we could deduce was happening in the test tube, and as I say, we could see that it was happening in cells by making this alteration in the RNA and then seeing it copied into the DNA. But the question was, did it matter for the cell? So we knew we had a template sequence, we knew elongation could take place in the test tube, but did it matter for cells? And so we could ask the question, how would these tetrahymena cells respond if telomerase no longer worked? Now, here's where science is great, because it was actually very serendipitous. Of course, we make it sound very, like, of course we meant to do this. But actually, we had a serendipitous mutation. Remember, I was just telling you about mutations that we were making in the template, and they got copied. But we found a freakish one. It was a freaky mutation in the RNA, and we actually found others as well. But it happened to be the C, where if you made a U, and again, we made it, but we just didn't think it would do anything weird. But what it does is very interesting. It distorts the enzyme active site. And so now, this U warps the enzyme's ability to do copying. So it makes the A, but then it actually causes the enzyme to stop. So it just dribbles out a nucleotide or two, and then it actually falls off. The DNA falls off. Very interesting, and it's part of another interesting story that's emerging, that the RNA and the protein are collaborating to make the active site of this enzyme. But for our purposes, it was just very fortunate, because basically it was a clean way to render this enzyme enzymatically incapable. So the whole thing was there, it was just unable to act. So now what happened to tetrahymena cells? Now, tetrahymena cells are not only handsome, but they're also cells that will grow forever. You feed them, you speak nice to them, they'll keep growing forever. That means they have really good DNA repair systems, by the way. They don't have to go through sexual cycles to do this. They can just multiply if you supply them with the right nutrients and conditions. So their chromosome, so now I'm depicting an example of one chromosome end. So this would be the big chromosome coming in from the left, and then these red ovals would be the repeated DNA at the end. And each time the cells divide, they have to replicate their chromosomes. And so what happens is that the chromosome ends never get shorter. They sometimes get a little shorter and a little longer, but they never sort of, you know, really change overall. And so these cells effectively are keeping growing, and they're also immortal, as I said. Now, we'd found that they had telomerase in them. Okay. Now, were these two related? Now, you have to be really careful when you see these two things together, because they could be completely unrelated. But we now had this trick. We could genetically inactivate telomerase by this surgical strike at the heart of the enzyme's active site, this lucky mutation. And then we found that as those cells kept multiplying for about 20 more divisions, the telomeres got shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter, and then they stopped dividing. The cells stopped dividing. They ceased divisions when the telomeres got too short. So in effect, we sort of struck at the heart of the ability of these cells to keep on being immortal by this very simple change, and we knew what we were changing. It was the telomerase core RNA component. So basically, pretty simple genetic finding. Cells immortal, mutate telomerase, cells become mortal. So that's the simple finding, and that was the principle that really has held up throughout all of the eukaryotes, or through the wide spectrum of different, you know, phylogenetic branches of eukaryotes that have this maintenance method of telomeric DNA. See, what happens is that the processes that allow DNA replication to take place can't replicate to the very ends. And sometimes nucleases, we now know, munch away at the ends of DNA. So something, it turns out, has to keep replenishing them, and most usually throughout the eukaryotes, it's telomerase. And so we found it first in this particular system, and then it's turned out to be generally true over and over again. Okay. So now the question is, how does this play out then, this idea that the solution to this problem of telomeres dwindling away, which they will unless something, telomerase, maintains them, how does this play out in other systems? So this is the idea here. Well, this has been the subject of much research by many laboratories in the last couple of decades. And essentially, I've drawn this incredibly simply, but what's really going on is that this DNA sequences are clothed by very elaborate proteins that both shield the end from telomerase action and then invite telomerase action when telomeres are too short. It's very complex, beautiful dance of many, many different genetic products regulating the addition of telomeric DNA in such a way as to prevent the telomeres getting too short. And so this capping off the ends of the chromosomes is this sort of elaborate system of telomere-telomerase interactions. And I could draw you all sorts of parts, pieces, you know, and so on, but I'll just depict a kind of idea. So I was in a museum once in Berlin, and I saw this beautiful Greek sarcophagus, and this is just two sides of it, actually, but it reminded me that this was like one of these chromated ends here, right, and this would be the other one here, ending down here. And then there's this beautiful, it's this beautiful elaborate structure. It's kind of like the chromosome end structures. They're really beautifully elaborate structures. And then there's this sort of fabulous prancing creature around, and that's telomerase, and it's, you know, at the end, right. And so it's this really interesting dance that the cells carry out. And so we in many labs still are very interested in all of the molecular events that accompany all of that. And they're wonderful and elaborate, but not the subject for today's talk. So what I want to talk about now is now the simple ideas which I've shown you got established in Tetrahymena and other model systems. I want to tell you about how do they play out in humans and what sorts of things are being learned now. So the first thing is that telomerase is in many, many different human cells, and I'll describe a little bit more what they are. And as you saw for Tetrahymena, you know, it's good news, right? It lets cells keep on multiplying and replenish themselves if they're cells and tissues, because telomerase is protecting the telomeres by keeping them topped up all the time with sufficient DNA to protect by having appropriate proteins bound to them. And so that's good. And in the context of normal, healthy cells of the body, which is going to be the subject of most of what I'll be telling you about, this is clearly good news. But there are cells that we would very much rather did not keep multiplying. And this is the other side of telomerase's life. And that is the cancer-promoting properties of telomerase in the context of cancer cells. And I think this is very important to make clear that the consequences of telomerase action for what we would care about, human, you know, health and well-being and so on, are very different whether telomerase is acting in the context of normal cells, where I'll describe the correlations are really quite interesting with respect to human health and disease, as opposed to in the context of cancer cells, where you don't want the cells to keep on multiplying indefinitely. Because that, of course, is a characteristic of cancer cells. And so many labs have looked at cancer cells and have noticed that in the great majority of the common human tumors especially, telomerase is really quite hyperactive. And that makes actually good sense, given everything I've told you, because one of the characteristics of cancer cells is they do keep multiplying. And so it certainly makes sense at a minimal level that the indefinite division of cells would be promoted by the fact that their telomeres don't run down because the telomerase keeps them up. And this is all true. So in the context of cancer cells, this hyperactive telomerase actually makes sense. Now, there's a whole lot more to it, and I'm not going to be talking about it, but I want to alert you to the fact that in human cancer cells, this hyperactive business has been puzzling, because why so active? Why so much? I mean, you know, it's not that difficult to maintain telomeres with small amounts of telomerase. And so it's turning out, and I'll just tell you this interesting finding, and that is that the telomerase in cancer cells seems to be promoting other cancer properties and, in fact, influencing the signaling pathways that make cancer cells so malign. Cancer cells, as you know, are deaf to all entreaties to stop multiplying. They're deaf to signals to, you know, stay where they should stay in the body and not go invading where they shouldn't. They utilize glucose in ways called the Warburg effect, shades of my old University of Melbourne days when we learned about metabolism then. So anyway, the point being, though, that telomerase is influencing signaling pathways that make cancer cells more malign in various ways. So the hyperactivity of telomerase may be interesting there. Now, I'm not going to tell you about the kinds of therapeutics that one might imagine to try to exploit this highly active telomerase, because none of them are close to the clinic now in any sort of useful way. And there's some very early phase one trials going on to try to inhibit telomerase in cancer cells. But there's other ways that one could perhaps try to knock it down and try to stop this hyperactivity and perhaps help cancer cells be less cancerous. One could also make cancer cells, which have a lot of telomerase, one can also try to make the telomerase make telomeres that can't protect the ends properly, and then all the chromosome ends stick together like glue and the cancer cells die. So we're trying these different approaches, but they're all very preclinical, although very interesting in terms of revealing interesting properties of telomeres. I really want to focus, though, on telomerase in a different context, and that is in what we hope our body is pretty much full of, and that is in normal, healthy cells in the human body. Okay, this facet of telomerase action. And just to sort of point out that telomerase didn't make the cancer cells initially cancerous. They usually undergo a series of stages, often well before the clinically manifest cancer appears, which are putting them on the trail or the road of being cancerous down the line. And telomerase activation does not appear to be a necessary early stage in this. So these cells are sort of, you know, bad news well before the telomerase starts making them bad news, but it doesn't help. It's just that in the context of cancer cells, that telomerase is bad news. But in the context of normal cells, as I'll describe, we think it's a different story. So where do we find telomerase in human cells? Well, as I said, it's hyperactive in the great majority of human tumors, including the common epithelially derived tumor types. But telomerase in normal cells is active, first of all, where you would expect it. Now, you expect it to be active in cells that are going to be perpetuating themselves forever. So that would include, of course, the germline cells, right? I mean, these are the cells that give rise to the next generation. We're still here, so, and telomerase does indeed show activity in germline cells and in various stem cell compartments. Certainly quite active in embryonic stem cells, and one can see activity in various adult stem cell types as well. And that makes sense because these cells have long-term replenishing and replicative abilities. What was interesting in more recent years is that telomerase has shown up even in cells that appear not to be having much replication property themselves. And yet one does find telomerase very high, very regulated levels, often quite damped down, but quantifiable, and that we've found is a very interesting kind of measure that you can have, the quantifiability of telomerase, not in necessarily stem or germ cells, which you can't always look at easily, but in cell types that you can look at. And primarily what I'm going to mean is in blood, white blood cells that can be obtained in a blood draw, you know, in healthy participants in studies will give a blood draw. Now, we do also know, actually, that telomerase, if you look hard, we can even find it in even such things as primary, neuronal cells. And telomerase may be helping to cap off the ends of chromosomes as well as add DNA to it. So this may not be as sort of unnecessary as it may seem on the surface to have telomerase. If you said, well, why do you need telomerase if cells are not multiplying? There's some evidence that telomerase can help cap off and protect chromosome ends, even if cells are not dividing. Now, the point is, there's quantifiable amounts of activity of telomerase in many cell types in normal adults. And this was thought not to be the case for many years because by comparison with the levels per cell in many different cancer cell types, this seemed rather small and negligible and sometimes was missed. But actually, it's there. Okay. So let's imagine then what are the consequences if you had various levels of telomerase. Well, based on what I told you with tetrahymena and, you know, systems that have plenty of telomerase, such as cancer cells, there'll be shortening. But if the shortening processes and the lengthening by telomerase are balanced over time, then over time, as cells go through repeated divisions, the DNA will sometimes get a little longer, a little shorter, so on and so on, but generally sort of stay on average the same. Telomeres won't dwindle down and cells will keep dividing or have the potential to keep dividing, you know, unless other factors intervene, of course. But there's actually no law that says telomeres always have to shorten. In fact, it's been clear in B cells, in germinal centers of the body, which are, you know, part of the immune system, where cells go through certain sorts of developmental processes, that Ahodas' lab showed, you know, at least a dozen years ago, that those cells have some upregulated telomerase. And in fact, the telomeres, if anything, get longer for a while as these cells divide. So there's no law that says in adults telomeres have to, you know, shorten, because sometimes telomerase can be regulated upwards a bit. But it's clear that in some cell types there is some shortening. And so now you could imagine that the shortening processes are going on. But if you had some telomerase, you could sort of stave off the shortening. You know, there'd be sort of some shortening, but there'd be some lengthening. But, you know, eventually the race would get lost if the balance was tipped over. And eventually the telomeres would get too short and the cells would cease to divide. And the common response to that is something called senescence, where the cell ceases to divide. And then if there were less telomerase, all other things being equal, then you might expect, okay, well, it would come sooner, the shortening processes would overwhelm the lengthening sooner, and so senescence would come sooner. So what we would expect then, as for any highly regulated process in cells, would be that there would be a lot of influences in this. We could imagine, and it's true, that there's a lot of genetic influences and a lot of things we've been interested in that I'm going to tell you more about, and that would be perhaps there might be non-genetic influences on this. Okay, so what about genetic influences? Now, that's always much more straightforward, and if you can do the genetics and trace effects back to mutations, either experimentally made, as in mouse mutations, or by unfortunate spontaneous mutations occurring in human populations, or more likely in rare cases in human families, then if you can trace it back, then you know you've got cause and effect. So there are certain mutations that can be made in mouse to knock down or out telomerase, and that occur by very bad luck in some human families that knock the level of telomerase down. So you know what the cause was. Indeed, as in tetrahymena, when you made tetrahymena unable to maintain its telomeres, even in humans where there's only a partial knockdown of telomerase, one sees that telomere length maintenance is compromised. The telomeres are a lot shorter in the family members in these pedigrees of people who have these unfortunate inherited diseases in telomerase genes. And even though one gene copy from, say, one parent is okay, the other parent's contribution of gene copy is mutated, and even though there's some telomerase, it's not enough, the telomere length is compromised compared with their unaffected family members or siblings. So that, in turn, has an effect. It reduces the ability of cells to replenish throughout the lifetime of the person, and indeed has quite severe effects in terms of certain diseases, notably progressive bone marrow failure. And so such people usually can't live to old age. Okay, so other things that happen are quite interesting because you start to see things which are more general. The bone marrow failure is prominent because, remember, immune system cells which come from the bone marrow have to be replenished very extensively throughout life. But other things, other phenotypes show up in the mouse as well. One sees some cardiovascular fibroses. One sees proneness to cancer as well. And you might say, well, how does that work? wait, I thought telomerase was high in cancer cells. But telomerase is also protecting the ends of chromosomes from sticking to each other, which is what happens if they get too short. The telomeres get too short. Telomeres stick to each other. The genome becomes unstable. And that's one of the hallmarks of cancer. So it seems as if, in humans, having insufficient telomerase makes people prone to cancers as well. And so that says telomerase is important in the normal cells. Okay, so these, in quick summary form, we know genetic changes in telomerase, deliberate in the case of the mice experimental systems, accidental, of course, in the case of the humans, but we know cause and effect here. We know that this causes, it has severe impacts on people. So now what about a non-genetic effect? And our colleagues, who I'm going to introduce by name in a minute to you, at UCSF, we're very interested in a particular form of non-genetic factor in life, and that was chronic psychological stress, which is clearly non-genetic, at least in the circumstances that have been studied by these groups. And that, too, has been documented to have disease effect, for example, cardiovascular disease risk. So this... kind of stress, which involves the sort of stress where the person for many years often is in a situation where they feel it's out of control, they're overwhelmed, they don't have resources to cope for it, they feel it's unpredictable, and such things have been quite well documented to have, for example, effects on cardiovascular disease risk. So my colleagues at UCSF, particularly led by Alyssa Eppel in the Department of Psychiatry at UCSF, and then several other colleagues in and out of UCSF, we're interested in, well, what might chronic life stress do to the kind of cellular aging that you can think of as being exemplified by this telomere shortening? And so Jolin was the person in my lab who led the charge, ably assisted by Josh and Kyle. And we had several collaborators here. But Alyssa came by some years ago to my lab and talked to me, and she said, what happens with telomeres with people under chronic stress? And I said, I don't know, but, you know, it'd be worth looking, right? And so the question was, for chronic psychological stress, obviously mediated through the brain, does it have any effect on telomeres in the cell type that we can look at in human participants who are not ill, and those are the white blood cells. And so just to sort of now home in very specifically on the study, which is not new now, but I just want to sort of give you a more precise idea of our initial findings. What we found was that in a group of, a cohort of mothers who were the caregiver for their own child who's chronically ill with one disease or another, and we also had a control group of matched mothers, and very carefully designed study by my colleagues. And so they said, with the levels of perceived stress, which you can quantify on scales, or the duration of the caregiving situation, that would obviously be for the caregiver mothers, and it ranged from 1 to 12 years, are they related to markers of cell aging? And the ones we were interested in were the ones related to telomere maintenance. And so I'll show you in summary form some of the results. So here are the high-stress quartile in the red bars. And so their telomerase was lower than the low-stress quartile, and so was their telomere length. And that difference was actually quite significant. And then you could correct for all sorts of things you might think might confound this result, and this relationship really held quite significantly. And if you compared the sort of average shortening over thousands of people in the population that occurs very slowly on average over the years of life, and we're going to return to that point, but if you look at that sort of population average, you could sort of come up with a number that this was, you know, equivalent to some extra years of chronological age, if you will, for the high versus the low stress group. So that was the first indicator, and the second indicator that there was something interesting going on came from the number of years the mother had been in the situation and relationships with telomere length in the white blood cells and telomerase. I just show you some of the data for the white blood cells, and what you can see is there was a general relationship there. Similarly for telomerase, the longer she had been in this situation, even after you correct for every possible thing you can, and obviously age is one of them, but you can correct for all these other things in this very carefully phenotyped cohort, the shorter were her telomeres, and the lower was her telomerase. So this was our first hint that there might be a relationship between chronic stress and telomerase and telomere length maintenance. So that was our very first study. And now we and others have now been continuing on this. So I just want to tell you, and others have replicated this kind of thing in much larger cohorts, but I want to tell you some of the interesting things we've been seeing. So here's some more data, but now this is a different study. These are now also very stressed caregivers, and again, we have control groups. These people are the caregiver, and they're much older, of their husband, their partner, who has dementia. And they're the primary caregiver. And so, again, they're often under a range of stresses, but the range is reasonably high. This is the perceived stress scale. And you can see, again, a relationship with the how bad the stress was, and telomeres were generally shorter. And I do want you to notice the scatter, because, you know, this is not, absolute. You can see someone very low stress would have similar telomeres with somebody who has very high stress. Notice that. We're talking about statistical trends here. We have to be very careful that we can't, say necessarily just because you saw this length of telomeres that that's going to say something about what their stress was. But statistically, this was this kind of thing, and it exactly mirrored what we'd seen with this other cohort. Now, we also looked in these groups at other measures that might try to pick up on things that had operated longer than the perceived stress scale, which measures essentially stress in the last month, and samples it then. And so if you look at an eating disorder, cognitive dietary restraint, which is a distressed behavioral pattern in which one can quantify the degree of its severity by something called, for example, the Dutch Eating Behaviors Questionnaire Scoring. Again, it says, questionnaires, you're scoring it on this scale here. But interestingly enough, telomere lengths can't lie, even though they might have lied here, but whatever it is, there we saw this relationship. I've just shown you the data for the postmenopausal women. We saw very similar data set for our cohort of premenopausal women. Other sorts of things also, interestingly, almost eerily, keep showing these relationships. One can measure dispositional pessimism by a questionnaire in which all the questions that relate to pessimism are carefully buried in other questions so the person can't guess what you're trying to get at. And so when you do this, though, you come up with a scale, and rather sort of intriguingly, there again we saw a relationship between shorter telomeres and worse dispositional pessimism. A personality characteristic thought to be operative over perhaps fairly large numbers of years. So any one of these could have been a freak, but the consistency of this is really quite striking. So the idea is that then perhaps there are things, not only genetic, but other non-genetic factors that may be influencing the trajectory of telomeres over time. So why would you care? This is all very nice, but what does it matter? Well, interesting relationships are emerging between health and telomere length. And I think this is a nice, simple one. It's an old cohort. It's the health ABC stories. The health ABC cohort. And so this is quite an elderly cohort of people. And they're being followed over several years. But the numbers were reasonably large. And interesting, the parameter that fell out was years of healthy life was related to, long, just simple telomere length. And that's a good, meaningful parameter, because years of healthy life is the kind of parameter that people care about as you're getting old. It's your healthy life that you care about. So another interesting connection was with telomerase in our first study group and how it related to the major known diseases of predictors of cardiovascular disease. Now, just to sort of set the stage here, for example, in this very large study of over 29,000 people in 52 different countries and 6 continents, so probably Australia is included. I presume they missed out Antarctica. But the 6 major prominent risk factors are these, as you might expect. But interestingly, they included the kind of psychological stress that our study had included. Now, because this was a carefully phenotyped and examined cohort, we also had data on all of these other risk factors. We did not have it for diabetes, because to be in the study, everybody had to be healthy. They all had to fit a fairly sort of narrow set of criteria so you could compare more easily among them. And so we had fasting insulin and glucose, though, which if high will be a risk factor for diabetes, the risk factor itself. So this would be sort of a proxy for that risk factor. But the interesting relationship was that all of the risk factors, and it was fasting glucose, in this, that we found all of these were related to lower telomerase activity in the bad direction. So each one of these. So of course there may well be interdependencies among these, but it was interesting that each of them went with lower telomerase activity in the white blood cells. And that's implying that these white blood cells have less proliferative capability. So again, we saw interesting relationships with how cardiovascular function is, just physiologically, and telomerase. So we're now again in the first cohort, the caregiver mothers and the controls, and all of them agreed to go through a laboratory psychological stress test. And of course, you know, we do all the telomerase activity and telomere lengths. Of course, we do all these blinded, so we don't know who is who. But it was very interesting when you put these two data sets together. So for the low telomerase activity, half of people, where you just split the telomerase activity that everybody had into the low half and the high half, then if you looked at their heart rate or their pulse pressure, first of all, when they're sitting resting, you can see that already their resting heart rate is lower and pulse pressure is lower for the high telomerase group here. Okay, this is high frequency heart rate variability, which is a measure of adaptability of the heart to changing demands. So that is good if it's high. Now these people had been resting for a while, but then they were asked to do an unpleasant social test. It's called the TRIA social stress test. But what it consists of is anticipating giving a videotaped speech, giving a videotaped speech, and then doing some unpleasant mathematics, subtracting large prime numbers from each other. But the key is that in this very controlled laboratory environment, trained personnel look at them without facial expression as they go through these tasks. And so you react in an emotional, or sort of, you react to this physiologically, you react. But how you react, your heart rate going up and your pulse pressure going up, was really different depending on whether you were in the high telomerase half or the low telomerase half, just a median split. So quite an interesting difference here, because you know, so we're not saying that the low and high telomerase caused this difference here, but it's certainly related in an intriguing way. High frequency heart rate variability, so you know, this is, it's good to be high rather than lower. So the interesting thing was that the two halves sort of pulled out separately. Okay, now why would we care about this? Well, this sort of pattern, this overreactivity, the higher resting a heart rate and pulse pressure, and this overreactivity upon this social stress, you know, this is more predictive of heart problems to come. So none of these people had frank heart disease at the time. So not only do we see these connections here, but there have been a lot of studies now around the world where people have looked almost always just at telomere length. Now, people didn't think telomerase was in white blood cells, and so they didn't bother to look at telomerase. And it's a bit hard to do quantitatively, but we do it very carefully. But so most of the studies have been just with short, looking at telomere length. But one finds a very intriguing overall pattern. So telomere shortness has been linked with a lot of common diseases and disease states. And I'll list them here on the left, and the citations on the right are really incomplete. I just apologize, I don't have them all in, but the pattern is very clear. So proneness to cancer, and this includes some quite interesting things such as progression from Barrett's esophagus to esophageal cancer, for example, pulmonary fibrosis, cardiovascular disease, obviously a common disease of aging, vascular dementia, degenerative conditions, including osteoarthritis and osteoporosis, and diabetes, and in fact, general risk factors for such chronic diseases, all have been linked in cohort after cohort with shorter telomeres. So quantitatively, that's what's tracking the risk factors or incidence of these diseases. So it's a very intriguing connection, and this is why we're interested in shortness of telomeres, because of this continuously seen set of associations, and these are associations. But we're interested in the malleable aspects of this too, because, as I mentioned, we now really think that the signal input which we can think of to the brain, which of course would be some form or other of the chronic stressor or stressed situation, that somehow is mediated through doubtless complex physiology, perhaps involving stress hormones. You know, there's a lot of pathways that can be doing this, but we can read it out quantitatively as telomere length maintenance. And so we see this relationship. We see from all of those multiple cohort studies relationships between telomere shortness and disease impact. And so is this pathway operating through telomere shortness, the chronic stress operating to cause its disease impact through telomere shortness, or you know, are there parallel pathways or a combination or something like that? But there are enough linkages between chronic stress and telomere shortness, there's enough linkages between telomere shortnesses and disease impact to make us think that we really need to think very seriously about how much weight to put on these various couple of different question marks, that it operates through telomere shortening or it operates independently. Okay. So either way, I found this very interesting thing from somebody who's been in Toronto University for many, many years, and who said every stress leaves an indelible scar, and the organism pays for its survival after a stressful situation by becoming a little older. So that seems to be getting a kind of a concreteness with respect to looking at these quantitative effects on telomere maintenance. So now the question is, I've sort of depressed you all immensely, right? And but what's really interesting now is that now what's emerging is that the situation seems to be more malleable than had been thought. So what had been thought before? As I said, people thought, well, adult cells didn't have telomerase because they couldn't really detect it. And so they thought, well, maybe telomeres just shorten throughout life. And this was true. In the sense that if you looked at what's called cross-sectional studies, that was true. That means if you took a person who was, 5 years and one who was 30 and one 50 and one 80, and then you looked at the telomere length and you did that for hundreds or thousands of people, you would get a very scattered relationship, but there'd be this general drift downwards. But actually, you could easily find people with, 30 years of age with telomeres as short as people with 80 years of age. So it wasn't a strict relationship. It was a statistical one, kind of like those curves I've been showing you, with a lot of scatter, but a statistically significant relationship. But that was cross-sectional. What does that mean? One time point's looked at for each person in these hundreds or thousands of people in the study. What happens if you look now longitudinally within individuals? The picture is completely different. So now, in studies now starting to come out, it's really clear that a goodly fraction of people show lengthening of their blood cell telomeres. In this case, I'm showing you the data from the MacArthur aging study. These were individuals who, starting off elderly people, but they're high functioning, high cognitive function, and their telomeres we looked at baseline, and then 2.5 years later. And a good quarter of them showed significant lengthening of the telomeres. And this was a very, it was demanding. You really had to lengthen quite significantly to be in the bin of lengthening. A lot of them stayed about the same, and then some indeed shortened. And so, in fact, if you looked overall at a population, more likely to shorten than lengthen, but a significant number of people have telomeres that lengthened, right? And this is not a freak of this study. Here's a Swedish study looking over 10 years, reported the same kind of thing. Here's a study that our colleagues at UCSF and the VA hospital in San Francisco did over a 5-year period. Again, a significant fraction of people showed lengthening of their telomeres in a 5-year period, in this case 10-year period, in this plot, 2.5-year period. So telomeres can lengthen as well as shorten. Okay, so this is interesting because that suggests maybe things could change. Now, why might you care? Okay, so part of the MacArthur study had a very interesting aspect of it, and it's looking at mortality. And so this study was actually carried out longitudinally and carried out for 12 years. And so people in the study had their telomeres measured at baseline, this arrow here, and then measured 2.5 years later, as I just showed you. So some people's telomeres were lengthened and stayed the same. And then you said, who died? Who died cardiovascular deaths? And these are the people who had the telomeres maintained or lengthened. That's their Kaplan-Meier survival curve for cardiovascular death. These are the people whose telomeres shortened in that period. In this period. That's their Kaplan-Meier survival curve. So it was about 3 times more likely you'd die in the subsequent 12 years after that baseline draw, depending on what had happened in this 2.5 year period. You know, a little bit like a rough crystal ball as to what would happen in the subsequent years in terms of cardiovascular deaths. So something to start taking notice of. And the question is, can you do things about it? And so our colleagues in San Francisco and the VA hospital, as I said, have been looking at cardiovascular disease. And I just wanted to show you this recent interesting one where in these people, this is a cohort of people, and they have stable coronary artery disease, but it's stable. They're doing, you know, they're hanging in there, fine, okay. But so what they looked at was their omega-3 fatty acids in their erythrocytes, that is their red blood cell membranes. How much omega-3 fatty acid did they have in their red blood cell membranes? The reason that's an interesting one is because that's the dietary, it was the dietary marine form of omega-3s. So the more omega-3 they had, they were put in the different quartiles like this. So the higher was the omega-3 level, the more, you know, they fell into these categories here. And then you looked at, that was at the beginning, and then you looked at the telomere length at the beginning and at the end. And then you look to say, how much did the telomere length fall? So the more it fell, the more down it goes on this axis. So what was found was that the more omega-3 you had at the beginning, the less telomere shortening you underwent in that next 5 years. So again, the omega-3 fatty acid levels in your blood cells predicted the rate of the subsequent falling of telomere length. And I just showed you, it was kind of interesting to know what the rate of telomere length was, because that predicted in a different study. So we haven't connected the two, but it did predict cardiovascular death. Now, we're talking, by the way, about these particular omega-3 fatty acids, which come from dietary fish sources, you know, such as fish oil and so on. So those are the ones we're talking about. And those ones themselves have a very respectable history of being linked to better cardiovascular disease survival. So, you know, the American Heart Association, I'm sure the Australian Heart Association says, make sure you have, you know, dietary sources of omega-3 fatty acids, because that does predict less incidence of more cardiovascular disease, especially for people who've already had it. Okay, so anyway, interesting thing, because that suggests there's something you can do about it. So we're now doing prospective studies, randomized, to see, well, what happens in feeding studies. But this is an interesting observational study. And it suggests, again, you know, there's interesting influences on that will very likely include non-genetic components, such as the sort of thing suggested here. This is just for the skeptics among them. Of course, I'm a great skeptic when you see all these things. And so this is just saying, even though you try and correct for all of these different factors that you might have expected to affect telomere lengthening, you still found the probability. Remember, some people's telomeres lengthened. That probability of them lengthening was very strongly related to the omega-3 fatty acid levels. These nice low p-values, even after you adjust for all of these other sorts of things, and the p-value still remains very convincing. So again, it looks like this level of omega-3 fatty acids is an important component. But it doesn't say it was all dietary, because there could have been other influences on what the levels were. So that's why we have to do the prospective controlled study, randomized study before. So what we're seeing is a picture where we're seeing influences on telomerase activity and telomere length, which certainly do include genetic components. There's no question there'll be those components, not just rare disease. I'm sure there'll be common variations as well. But we're also seeing non-genetic ones, and that's interesting because that suggests there are malleable and potentially alterable components to it. Why this is important is that we're seeing these close, convincing, sort of consistent relations with telomerase and telomere length and risks for aging-related disease, of which I've listed a prominent group here. I haven't talked about mental disorder, but we have data emerging for that. So this is why we think this is an interesting interesting set of relationships here. And so I'm going to just summarize now. I think I've made the point, I hope, that it's good to maintain your telomeres, and in fact it might even be crucial to maintain telomeres. I talked very briefly, but I didn't take you through data, but just alluded to the fact that cancer cells have hyperactive telomerase, and in fact there's ways that one could potentially exploit that and sort of make the cancer cells particularly vulnerable because of their overly active telomerase compared with normal cells. And like any other anti-cancer approach, of course, it's important to always be thinking about differential effects on cancer versus normal cells. So that's definitely, you know, an emerging and evolving story. I talked to you about chronic psychological stress and showed you that it's associated with, and we have some reason to think it may be causally involved in, shorter blood cell telomeres. And the shorter blood cell telomeres are interesting, for example, because rate of shortening is now linked with cardiovascular disease mortality. And as I showed you recently, we see risk factors for cardiovascular disease progression, for example. And interestingly enough, there's now some data that suggest that the rate of shortening is not inexorable, and in fact, lengthening can be seen. And so what we're interested in now is going forward with controlled, randomized, prospective studies of various interventions to see whether this is reversible, because we think if there's a causality with the disease processes, then reversibility of telomere maintenance loss may turn out to be something that you can use to monitor reductions in disease risk. And I really want to sort of stop there, but think a little bit about this whole idea that you're of reducing disease risk. You know, we have in many developed societies, we have a burgeoning population of elderly, reasonably healthy people, and the goal is for people to have maximum number of years of healthy life. I think that's sort of the goal that most people have. I don't think most people want to be 500, but, you know, just have maximum years of healthy life. And so what's interesting is that this kind of parameter that we've been looking at seems to be related over and over to the sorts of diseases that, if staved off, can then equate to years of healthy life. But very often, the major killers of the elderly, which are cancer, cardiovascular disease, and diabetes, are things that are quite variable and seem to have non-genetic, as well as obviously genetic, but seem to have non-genetic components. And so we're really very interested in how you can try to use this kind of information where you have, if you will, a biomarker, perhaps something that's even more causal, thinking about using this in the context of prevention. And so I, for my sins, I'm upcoming president of the American Association for Cancer Research. And so, you know, started to really think, well, what's important? And what we've learned so much about cancer cells is a great deal of biology, which allows one to try all sorts of therapeutic approaches against cancers that have developed. But that's the cancer horse is out of the stable. Many of the early changes in cancer cells were taking place over years, well before you could see the cancer. And now more and more people are thinking, now we understand this biology, perhaps we can sort of prevent cancers. And so this finding that telomere maintenance, when it's not working properly, also makes you cancer prone is just one of the things that personally prompted me to start thinking about what a lot of people are now thinking about for cancer prevention, not just not smoking, which of course is clearly a form of cancer prevention, but the kinds of cancer prevention where you're trying to go earlier and earlier and try to intervene and try and stop progression, even at stages where you well before you see the actual clinically manifested cancer. And so for perhaps all of these large sort of groups of diseases, the common diseases of aging, this idea that you could perhaps go earlier and earlier and try to monitor what's going on before the frank disease appears, and then try to see what quantitatively will be malleable, I think this might be a sort of valuable thing to be thinking about as we think about the issues of our larger demographic of aging, and we hope, healthy people into many years of old chronological age. So that's where we are right now, and I want to just point out that I have a wonderful group of people who work with me. This is a sort of crop of current and recent members, and I've alluded to just a couple of the people who specifically contributed to some of the work I was telling you about, and they're the ones who really make it all happen, and I come to wonderful Australia, and but they're really a wonderful group of people. I'm very lucky to have such terrific people who work with me. And then over the years, not all at once, over the years I've got support from all sorts of different sources, and again, that's what's made all of it possible, and I thank you very much for being here.
Got two things to say. First off, congratulations on your prize.
Thank you.
And the other thing is, if you're looking for a new cohort of chronically stressed students, PhD students...
Sorry. No, we actually have to point out, turns out it's people out of control of the situation. You chose to be a PhD student. No, seriously, I think it's a very serious point, and we really need to get the language better and more precise, because there are different kinds of stress. And of course, you know, I'm talking to you, this is stress, right? Running a marathon is stress. Doing a PhD, I agree, it does have its times when, but it doesn't seem to be that high education goes with low telomeres, quite the opposite.
Well,
nice try.
My actual question was more based on the actual action of telomerase itself in terms of the introduction of RNA to a DNA source, which is typically characteristic of retroviruses such as the AIDS. In terms of evolution of eukaryotic cells, which is something our lab looks at, do you think that this is a possibly some sort of gene or a action taken from viruses into eukaryotic cells?
No, it's very interesting. What's the origin? So people have looked at the TERT protein, which is the easiest to follow because the RNA evolves a bit more rapidly and makes it harder to track back into ancient history. But the protein, if you look at the various ones, it's actually closest to something called group 2 retroposons, which are eukaryotic. And which doesn't tell you a whole lot, because you could say, well, actually telomerase evolved from those. But the other way around is perhaps those evolved from telomerase. And it's unclear, but there's a very nice idea that perhaps, well, there's different theories, but one of them would be that bacterial genomes, which are typically circular, as you know, that if retroposons started jumping around and fragmenting the genome, then telomerase would have to evolve from these sorts of elements that existed and that had fragmented the genome and made linear chromosomes in order to cope with the end problems. So it's very interesting to know who evolved from whom. My personal bias, only bias, is that because the common situation is viruses borrow genes from cells. You know, that's the typical thing. They sneak genes from cells and then turn them to their own viral purposes. So on that basis, you would say, well, maybe it's more likely that these mobile elements, you know, of which viruses are a particular type of thing, that perhaps they borrowed telomerase from eukaryotic cells. But I think it's going to be really fascinating to try to think this through. So if you have any ideas that you should... But it's a very interesting question. And when did the RNA come in? Did the RNA acquire a protein? Because, of course, RNA can be catalytic and polymerize, given the right substrates. And you can make RNAs, engineer them, that will polymerize nucleic acids. And so did telomerase evolve from an RNA that just got smart enough to get a protein to do some of the heavy lifting eventually? Or did a protein type of thing acquire an RNA that it then turned to its... ends. So I love these questions, and there's a lot we don't know about the telomerase RNP. We study it in yeast, and it's got interesting other subunits, and the RNA protein interactions are fascinating.
Thank you very much for such a great and enjoyable and informative talk. I guess one thing that we could take away would be we should smile and smile often to each other to promote...
Well, I think the strict number was pessimism. That was the thing. And I'm not sure that, you know, does the obverse optimism necessarily work? One has to always say, this is what the cohort said, and I'm kind of careful not to over-interpret. But it seems as though the perceived stress and how people cope with it was important. But on the other hand, you know, we don't want too many little sort of mindless optimistic people around. I'll tell you something interesting. Optimism didn't specially track with it. It was pessimism. It was really interesting. So they're not two sides of the same coin, it turns out.
I have two simple questions. Of course, the first one is, do ladies have longer telomeres than men? The second one is telomerase activity a prognostic factor in cancer cells?
Yes. Not especially for the... some subtypes of cancers, it does seem as if that high telomerase tracks with the more malignant type. And there are certain cancers where that seems to be a relationship. But that's when things have, you know, advanced pretty far and the kind of cancer is what it is. So for certain cancers, it is indicative of the more malignant kind does track with the telomerase being higher. But that's not invariant for all cancers by any means. Do ladies have longer telomeres? It depends on the cohort. Some cohorts, initially it was published that they did. But interestingly, in the old Amish, which is an interesting cohort because it comes from a relatively small number of founder genomes, and there the men and women telomere lengths didn't look significantly different as you track them across age in a very statistical sort of way. Now, people, you know, generally in cohorts, women have longer longevity than men as well. Interestingly, that wasn't the case in the Amish. Now, you might be tempted to equate the two, and maybe they are causally related, but we can't say that. But interestingly, the answer was, it depends.
There was a hypothesis that animals that were generated by cloning from somatic cells had started their life with shortish telomeres and didn't have their telomerase reactivated and therefore died prematurely.
That was based on N equals 1 for Dolly, the sheep. It got a lot of publicity. There have been other clone studies, and so cloned cows, for example, it was actually the opposite. The cows did have longer telomeres than the cells, the somatic cells that gave rise to the cloned cows, and yet they also had a lot of problems of, you know, developmental problems, stillbirths, and so forth. Mm-hmm. So it looked as if the telomere shortness is not related to it, and actually that's not at all surprising because as soon as you admit telomerase into the equation, which, as I've shown you, can lengthen telomeres even in quite old people, then all bets are off. You know, you expected cloned animals to have shorter telomeres if somehow the clock just ticked inexorably. But now, if you know the clock can be turned backwards by telomerase, I used to say it's telomerase is like a naughty kid, you know, turns back the hands of the clock. But somebody at a meeting I was at recently, Dr. Lynch, if he's there, had a better one. He said it's like a crooked used car salesman turns back the clock, right? And so that's what telomerase does. And so now it's just a matter of the balance, you know, would it be more, would it be less? So it seems like telomerase lengthened the telomeres in general somewhat in the cows. In N equals 1 Dolly, it was shorter, but I don't know if that would equate to all sheep clones. So the generalization, I think, was premature.
And an ultimate question?
When the chronic stress is relieved, or yes, does telomerase activity rebound?
We're doing that in two ways. We're doing it observationally. We're following our cohort of the dementia caregivers over, we're out for 1 year and we're getting the data for 2 years now. And we're actually beginning to see relationships that suggest that it does track with change. So far it's observational. And the other way we're doing this is with intervention studies. And we've only done a pilot and published that late in 2008, just when the financial markets all crashed, turned out. But it was only a pilot, but it did show a 3-month change in a very sort of an intervention well documented to improve cardiovascular risk factors and cardiovascular progression and disease progression, and it did track how well you did in that in terms of how your cardiovascular risk factors improved at the 3-month versus the beginning. That tracked with how much the telomerase went up. But it was a pilot, and so now we're doing it with the proper control group and prospectively. So the hint so far is that one can see malleability. And this particular program included social support and stress reduction as well as exercise and eating more healthily. And people adhere to it very well, so it was effective.
So. Towards the back of the microphone. Final question from anyone?
In the front row. Liz, some of the fascinating correlations you talked about between short telomeres and disease would still raise the question of cause and effect.
Absolutely.
I wonder what you think about it. Can we be confident that the short telomeres cause the disease, or is it possible it's the other way around?
Yes. So I think it's likely to be a lot of potential feedbacks here. Now, you can certainly... Okay, we're looking at white blood cell telomeres, which is sort of a window on the functional cells out in the periphery of the immune system. And so that's what we're looking at. And so you could say, well, does the state of the immune system or its progression towards immunosenescence have any relationship with cardiovascular disease? And indeed, of course, there's quite a good literature that does link pro-inflammatory and immunosenescence properties with cardiovascular disease. So it could be that the short telomeres that we're seeing in this highly regenerated cell type, the immune system cells, that telomere shortening is actually causally contributing towards the cardiovascular disease effects or risk factors. Conversely, it could be simply a biomarker and be completely irrelevant, and then there's nothing that I think definitively argues one way or the other. The genetic alteration of telomerase, where you make it lower, you'd see these phenotypes, that argues that the short telomeres could be acting causally. But those genetic things are acting in somewhat more of a severe range. When you're up in the more normal range, that's the question. Is it rate limiting? I have a feeling that it's looking like it probably could be causal, but I think one should be super careful about making associations. This is why we like the chronic stress thing, because we can have an externality and we can see some directionality there, and particularly over the time dependence, where it's very hard to make an argument that that was not causal. And so I think there'll probably be a lot of complex feedback. You know, smoking, I mean, it ties very closely with low telomerase, but you know, it could be that the smoking is a very complex interplay of behavioral and other things. So, for example, one doesn't know how these things interact. So that's why I like the numbers, because you can treat it sort of as a genetic phenotype. You can say various phenotypes. You can take quantitative things like these telomerase levels, these numbers. You know the pathways will be immensely complex, but these numbers or phenotypes sort of integrate, I think, a lot of very complex molecular and cellular pathways.
There is a number of copies of Elizabeth's book, slightly discounted from the street site, and of course there's no postage, so please do so. But thank you very much indeed for coming tonight, and again, particularly to Professor Blackburn for a wonderful public lecture. Thank you.